Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of the Irish Examiner GAA podcast. Coming to you today from Tralee on the eve of the Kerry Senior Football Championship final between town powerhouses Austin Stacks and Cairns O'Rahillies. There might only be a mile of road between them, but they haven't met in a county final in Kerry since 1936. Whether you walk down Strand Road or up Rock Street, you can sense the atmosphere this week. You can smell the tension, and little wonder. This is a county final neither side dare lose. However, both the Rock and the Narries agree on one thing. If anyone deserves an 18-foot mural of a superstar in his pomp, it's Austin Stacks legend Mikey Sheehy. We sat down with the Kingdom Great this week to discuss now and then, happiness and health, the golden years, and Mick O'Dwyer. It's an hour long, so sit back and enjoy, or if you're in the car, mind the driving. Explain to me, for the uninitiated, the pecking order of Tralee football, because I know it's before my time, yeah. But back in the late 50s, John Dowling was the legend of Strand Road. Late 60s, Mikey.
Mitchell
won what, four or five in a row?
Five in a row.
Yeah, Tony Shea.
Derry Shea.
Derry Shea.
Clint Fitzgerald, Johnny Keller, Paulus for Coles.
Yeah.
Oh, the Sheehys.
The Sheehys.
Niall, Sean Oak, and Brian Seale.
And would it be fair to say then, from the 70s on,
yeah,
the Stacks have been kings?
Yeah, there would have been, I suppose, from the mid 70s. Well, from 73, that was the first county championship that we won in 27 years. And we would have dominated, I suppose, in our year on to the mid-80s. The last one we won in our time, I said it probably would have been the same. I finished up in 87, but we won 86.
Yes.
Against,
be Killarney in the final.
Be Killarney in the final.
I remember that.
We did.
So how many did you win in that 73 to 86?
We won five.
Five.
And we lost a few finals. Now, I don't know how many finals we lost in a few semi-finals. But you know what was very unfair, I suppose, in hindsight, when you look back at it, is that we were nearly always involved with Kerry playing an All-Ireland final the previous Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and the county final was on the following Sunday.
Yes.
At least nowadays they have the common sense to give them a break of maybe 2 weeks minimum after. Because I can remember, like, and it actually, you wouldn't get away with it nowadays. I mean, we were lucky enough that we won the All-Ireland, we'll say. But Jesus, you were celebrating.
You know, some of my friends in Cork, when they're taking the mickey out of me, they quote the likes of yourself and they say, like, yeah, I was lucky enough to win eight All-Ireland medals. Like, eight All-Irelands, five counties, and now a mural on a wall in Tralee.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
The mural, look, I knew nothing about the mural. And the truth is, for example, is that there was a mural of you at the back of the castle. So that's all I did.
So is it visible, Mikey, to the public?
No, it's not. You have to go into the back, into the car park, or else you have to go in there for a pint. You have to go to the toilet. You have to go to the back.
But it's a big, isn't it?
I've got, what's a big one?
It's impressive.
Just go into it, you know. I'm quite happy for it to send to the street.
Because you know why? I don't know why, and maybe there's another one down there. When I heard about the mural, I presumed it was on the corner of Pembroke Street there. You know, as you go around to the Golden Rooster,
I
thought that there was a big one there. When I heard it was going up the rock, there was something there one stage, wasn't there?
Oh, there was Shawnee Walsh, I think. They had something of Shawnee Walsh there. It was still there.
The catch against Dublin?
Yeah, the catch against Dublin and against Brian Mullins. That's
okay.
The one. But the guy that did it, or that does it, he did it in a smaller one, then kind of just a plain black one, just as you go around over, before you come to Radio Kerry, there are the traffic lights, turn right. It's just there in the corner of me. It's something similar. I'd say it was probably based on the same one then that he did. It was against Tyrone in 86. but he's led by the name of Mike O'Donnell. He actually played with Stax.
I remember him.
Lovely. He's a very talented guy at what he's doing, and he's done several of them.
Did you know about this mural before?
No, I had no idea about it. Genuinely, I swear to God.
He must have got some slagging off the crew.
Slagging, desperate altogether. Absolutely. Get out of it. But as I was saying, I have a free port on the castle bar the rest of my life, and I'll list the buyers. No. I didn't know. No, nobody said a word to me, but it didn't bother me.
Tell me, going back to that those 70s, and again, obviously for people who aren't au fait with Tralee football and Kerry football, that Stax team, Mikey, I mean, you grew up together in a way. I mean, or were you different vintages? Because there was John O, there was Ger Keefe, there was John L, there was yourself, there was Dinny Long, there was Powry.
The boys, I'd say John O, Powry, Ger O'Keefe. Tony O'Keefe, who was on the squad.
Oh, yeah.
Would have been around the same vintage. They would have been a couple of years ahead of me. So I wouldn't have played underage, under 16, we'll say. I did play minor with them, okay. Mm. So, and Dinny Langdon obviously joined the club whenever, was it late 70s or whenever. So we would, basically, though, you know, we all came together then, I suppose, at minor level. And then, obviously, at senior level, there was a great foundation. When you had four or five, fellas on a county team, which was always going to give you a base. And we were lucky enough that we were involved with Kerry at a very successful time.
And again, I'm interested now, because you know there's the whole politics at the moment in football about inter-county players and their commitment to the club or not.
Yeah.
How often realistically did you train, or did you even attend training with the Stax during the season back then?
We didn't really, genuinely, because Mico, who in my eyes is still the best manager, Gaelic manager of all time, Mico had a job to do. Mm-hmm. He didn't give one hoot about a club, I tell you straight out.
Right.
I know that myself.
Yeah.
And then in fairness, he was right, he had a job to do. He was the Kerry manager, he wanted Kerry to be successful. So he had first call on us, really, you know. So we missed the Pine County League games and that with the club. Now, Powry at the time probably was in Dublin, and John were in Dublin in the earlier years. So they'd have been training probably with Mihal and whatever. And they wouldn't have been down Barry for maybe county league games if we were allowed to play. But I would go down training if I was available. If we weren't training with Kerry, I'd go down. But you wouldn't do the full session. You'd go down, have a few kicks and try and be there. And, you know, I used to often say, in particular, as I said to you earlier on, if Kerry won an All-Ireland final and we won, like the boys, we wouldn't come up maybe till Thursday night before, and the county final then must have fallen on Sunday. That's very, very unfair on the ordinary club guy.
Yeah.
Even though they never, in fairness to them, they never protested about
it. And it wasn't just one coming back, it was probably three or four
three or four of us coming back, so it's really kind of, I suppose you could laugh at it nowadays, but you certainly wouldn't get away with it, certainly.
We're in your house here at the top. It's in Mona Valley, but I suppose it's an extension of the Rock in Moonies. Was that coincidence, Mikey, or when you were buying, are you conscious in Tralee of where you're buying a house?
No, because my son, Mike, he lives above in Strat Road, right in the middle of it.
Really?
Yeah, he bought up there. No, it didn't really, Tony, because when myself and Grandy got married, we built a house out in Farmers Bridge.
All right.
So I lived there for a few years.
So you could have played with Ballymac.
Could have played with Ballymac, is right. But came to town then. I think we came back in around 82. And it wasn't the fact that I wanted to specifically live here. And would you believe it? I was born and reared in Brendan's Park, which is my old family home. Would only be, 300-400 yards across the road inside Brendan's Park. So no, just completely coincidence.
Okay.
Yeah,
tell me how passionate or anxious or engaged you are with The Rock now. I mean, obviously you'll be there Sunday and it's a big one because it is Strand Road, but are you engaged or do you just go as an ordinary spectator?
I would say that's a good point. I'd say, no, I go as a spectator. I'm not involved in any capacity, but engaged. Funny enough, this year, for whatever reason is in it, I don't know, is that I find myself being far more nervous going to the games, not watching them, because I think they're exciting, you know that. And there is, there's I suppose the likes of Kieran Dunne, he's still being involved, and I was involved with him at Kerry level, and maybe it is that. And Wayne Quinlan, who I know quite well, the trainer, the young lads involved. And it's just, it's exciting. And I think people, particularly down the line, you know, Tim McMahon is chairman of the juvenile section, and the likes of Colin Lane. There's so many now, I hate mentioning names because I forget fellas.
Yeah.
But I think they have a fantastic underage structure within the club, and I think that's why. Now, maybe we're lucky enough in that in our area there's still development going on, you know, but I just think that the work as well that's been done by these guys and the coaches at underage level is serious stuff.
And
but I wouldn't have been involved, you know, the last time I was involved with the Sykes, I'd say it was with Billy Cotton. I can't even remember what year it was, for a couple of years, giving him a hand. And I would have been involved years ago. I'd say just 20 years ago, at under 16 at minor level.
Yeah, but like in fairness, you were a Kerry selector up to 2018 or something, was it?
I was involved 2018. I was involved with Charlie Nellick at minor level as well, at under 21. So I would always have been active. But funny enough, I'm more excited and nervous going to games this year, because I think that there's major hope, I suppose, and expectations of the squad that's there, and in particular. Tis only Wednesday, 1 o'clock on Wednesday, and I'm getting excited about the game on Sunday, particularly because it's Stranraer.
Yeah.
There's no doubt, and I have great friends in Stranraer, and funny enough, you mentioned him earlier on, John Dowling. Myself and John were great friends, myself and John would have a coffee every morning of 3 years.
He was in it. I mean, you know, you talk about your legend, you don't talk about your legendary status, you never do, but geez, even when I was young, John Dowling's name resonated around town, didn't it?
Oh, it resonated around town. And like, I mean, the work that meant. Like, I think it was John, like, the fruition when they won. They won in 2002, was it?
Yeah, they were beaten in the final in 2008.
And they were beaten in the final.
Yeah.
But it was definitely John's work. And yeah. John got them. Because they were. It was like when we were on top, Stranraer were poor. You know, and they were making it, but it was John Dowling's.
Yeah, he's kind of like the godfather of the club almost there, isn't he, Mikey?
Completely, absolutely. But as I said, a great time for him, because I remember an incident when I did my cruciate, actually, in 1987 or 88 it was. I'd say it was 88, was it? I played a club game with the Stags, and I knew I was ghost, and got injured anyway, and was at home feeling sorry for myself, and it was Easter Sunday. And there was no sign of me on the Tuesday. Obviously, the bank holiday was on the Monday. And I remember I was above in Farmers Bridge, above my own, because feeling sorry for myself, I was in crutches, and I knew my career was finished at next thing. But 11 o'clock on the Tuesday morning, there's a knock at the door. There's no mobile phones in those days.
Yeah.
John Doe.
Yeah.
John. What's wrong with you? I said, I think my knees go, isn't it sweet? Like, you know, that's standing, like, I mean, there was famous stories about John Dowling playing through the pain barrier. Like, you know, John couldn't understand. I said, I think my crusade has gone. He didn't know what a crusade was.
But
it was that genuine, like, and like, you think now of the rivalry that we would have had, like, you know.
Yeah.
And no, you would have so much respect for that man, you know.
Yeah, and of course his grandson is a key player.
Yeah, Barry John, a great lad.
Key player.
Yeah, he's a serious player. Like,
yeah, I heard he had a big semi-final, though, in fairness to him.
And he had a massive quarter-final as well.
Tell me, I want to go back a small bit. I would have to say probably Shane Lowry, Padraig Harrington, Donal Lennon and Mikey Sheehy.
Yeah.
What do those four men have in common? I've never met another or other sports people who achieve so much and are so, what's the word, modest about it. I'd say, like, in terms of, do you ever look back? I mean, you're certainly not a legacy hunter, but you must look back, Mikey, at times when you're making the tea here in the kitchen, say to yourself, Jesus, we had a great run at it.
I don't know. Sometimes you would, I suppose, you know, yeah, not very often, Tony. Like, you know, I get, I don't know, it's just the way I'm made up, really. And I suppose maybe it was the way I was reared at home. And my mother and father, we came from a great, great, lovely, happy family. And, you know, even since I've retired, which is 30 years plus, right? And if somebody starts talking about something, I'm not comfortable when they start talking about me. I just prefer to change the subject straight away.
Yeah.
And it's just the way I am. I always will be. Sometimes you do when you're on your own, and particularly now, like, say, big games coming up now, like championship matches, like Kelly are playing in, you do kind of, not as often as I would, you would kind of reminisce in your head, like, you know, you'll be saying, What I would always be thinking is, what are the players doing now, you know, on a Sunday morning? It's, you know, 11 o'clock, are they having a rub down or a break or a lie down or having a cup of tea or whatever, you know, just that. And you would think back then to old times, which was totally different. Like, I mean, the players nowadays, they go in the buses. We used to go in cars, like, you know, which was, we never went into Croke Park in a bus, you know, totally different. But you would remember and try and
come. Talk to me a little bit about that upbringing. I don't know, had you siblings, but I know, like, I mean, in terms of how you were reared, your mother and father, were they modest people?
They were very quiet people, yeah. My father was a fanatic and football. He was, right. That's when I got my interest in my wife. Six sisters, no brother.
All right.
So I was spoiled.
You were the golden child, literally.
Literally, well, and I just had a love playing football, and I was having a ball over in Brindley's Park up against the gable wall. And my mother then, and Paddy Shea, God rest him, used to always slag me before I got married, even though Grandma listened to me. No, she said, I used to do it as well. But when I used to come training in those days, you had your own gear. Nowadays they have their own gear laid out for them when they come training. But we used to have our own gear. But my mother, my poor mother, she used to have my gear perfect. She used to have it completely colour coordinated. In those days, I'd have usually to be maybe soccer gear you'd have on. Obviously, I'm a big Man United fan, and I wouldn't have had many Man United jerseys on me, but the one that I used to love wearing was the old Crystal Palace one. Right. It was a kind of a vertical or a horizontal stripes.
Yes.
And a kind of a light blue togs and the socks. And and different ones. And there was another one then, it was like a Birmingham City jersey and white togs and blue socks. But she used to have the whole thing colour coordinated for me. Then I used to have my two, three pairs of boots. And if I was training during the winter, she'd have Dublin. I don't know if you've ever...
I remember it.
She'd have the Dublin.
It's kind of a Vaseline.
To soften the boots and keep them perfect for me. Like, so,
yeah.
And probably she used to be laughing that they were more or less, you know, when I left home, that I wasn't as well taught out at all. Even though Granny would be too happy to hear that, though.
Yeah. No, actually, before we leave that subject about those little ticks that you had, over the years, two great stories I heard about you, and I want to find out if they're true or false. I was in Hennebury's one time years ago, and they said you used to come in the week before the All-Ireland or whenever it was, get your boots, and you always got them almost a half size too small.
Yeah,
is that true?
It's true, yeah. It's
what
true.
Was that? What was the
I don't know. It was just, I was very picky about my boots and about the size of boots. And, you know, I'd say if you had a camera, which they wouldn't have had, on me out in the field before a game started, I'd say it. Rip my laces and tie them again about 10 times.
In the warm-up?
I had this thing in my head. But Jesus, that maybe one of them is a little bit looser, you know. It was silly. So it was probably part of the tension on the day. But
it was probably part of your regime, because the other thing I heard about it, I forget who told it to me, but it's years ago, is, and you've probably said it there with your mother, is, the night before All Ireland's, you used to tog out, did you, in full?
Explain that to me.
I just
felt good. I'd have my jersey, obviously. I would have the jersey that we were wearing or something, but I'd have another Kerry jersey and just put on your gear and put up your socks. I don't know, it just made me feel good.
Yeah.
I don't know why. No, I'd do it out the back garden, obviously. I wouldn't be doing it for some reason, looking at it. And some people might say, wouldn't you do that after on kick and freeze or practice? No, but I used to just do it. It was just... Just the force of...
But it was a routine.
It was a routine.
Yeah.
Absolutely a routine, yeah.
And you, over the years, Mikey, did your routines, I mean, from your first All-Ireland in 75 all the way up to, was it 86, was your last All-Ireland?
My last one, yeah.
Did your routine change, or used you stick to it religiously and almost to the point of if anything went awry, your head was scrambled?
Yeah, I would say that's a good description. I would nearly stick to my routine. The only problem to choose, I was cranky the week of a big match in All-Ireland in particular.
Right.
And my poor mother again, like, and she would, you know, she'd take the brunt of it. And I wouldn't be cranky with her, but I'd be very snappy, you know. I wouldn't from maybe midweek on. And I remember at times then you'd have a ticket situation, and in those days, like nowadays, I see players, they get their tickets and they just give them to somebody to get rid of them.
Sure.
In our time, they'd be finished ringing you, even though there was no mobile phones, but they get you on the landline and they'd be ringing you below in the office, any chance of a spare ticket, you know. And it used to annoy me, like, you know. And then my poor mother, I think one year, I don't know, I can't remember, she said she was looking for a ticket for somebody on a Friday, and I said, man, gee, like, you know. And you know, this type of
thing. You didn't say Jeannie Mac, probably.
No, I didn't. Yeah. No, I didn't. But you know, no, but in general, I would have stuck to the routine fairly religiously.
But Shay was like that. I mean, there was a few of the boys like that. Paddy like was a fierce man for shows, wasn't he? Altogether,
buying the suit from Donny Rooney,
on
the Friday, he'd have to come in and he'd have to buy it from Donny Blown while he arrived. It was like, it was unbelievable. Yeah,
yeah.
He had to do it. Yeah,
and like, I remember Tomás and the boys were telling me, like, I mean, when he was actually leaving, but behind inventory. He'd be looking for particular little, like, cats or pigeons or crows that were kind of almost seeing him off, like, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, if, I suppose Dwyer wasn't, even though it was before psychologists, Mikey.
Yeah.
Like, Dwyer was actually a psychologist.
Oh, he was.
Wasn't he?
He was incredible. Because I know it from myself, you know, and he was the same with every player. And he'd tell you, you know, I've often quoted this, he'd tell you, you know, God, you need to get the banner, you know, you're carrying a bit of weight, you know, this will be sometime, you know, maybe towards the end of the league, get out and do a few runs, you know, and then later on in the season, then you'll be gone. Well, you know, and you would, like, you actually would do, if he'd ask you to run from Killarney after training back to Tralee, you'd do it for him.
Yeah.
And then, all of a sudden, then, you know, you were improving, and then he'd come and he'd tell you, like, you know, he said, geez, you're getting down. Sure, I mean, that was psychology at its best.
Yeah.
I remember after one All-Ireland semi-final, he said to me, I can't remember exactly what year it was. And he said, I felt good, physically very good at the time. And because I used to pick up injuries for whatever reason. And he says to me, you're in great nick now. He says, I've been doing very little with you.
Right.
I said, no, coming off the field, after the game, like going into the old dressing rooms under the Cusick stands.
And, yeah.
He said, I'll be doing very little, but you know, he said, between here and the final, it was about 4 weeks, you know. And another time then, I had been injured during the league. And again, years, not only I'm not 100% sure. And I missed the league final against Cork. I tore ligaments in my ankle. And I worked very hard to get back, and I did. And they were picking the team. And on the Thursday night, the usual pitch team were training in Killarney. And there was a bit of speculation that the team that won the league final might start.
Mm.
I don't know who played. I think maybe John Kennedy or whoever. And next thing anyway, I was doing as well as I could in training. And you're trying extra bit. And I remember after the shower, Tony, he followed me in when we'd finished. And he waited specifically until I was going out of the dressing room. And he called me and he says to me, I tell you now, he says, how are you feeling? I said, oh, I feel great. And he says, don't worry about the weekend now, he says, because there's a bit of speculation. He says, you'll be starting.
Right.
Jesus. Like I said to you, I'd have ran actually from Canary. Yeah. I would have driven.
And did he
have psychology? Like,
did he have that, Mikey, from 74? Or was that something, that loyalty and buy-in that just came after a few All-Irelands?
I think it probably came after a few All-Irelands, you know, because probably he learned as he went along, you know, he certainly improved that part of the thing. But I mean, the point I make about him, Tony, like when he took over, like, you know, in 75, he had been a selector with Johnny Cullis in the previous year. But when he took over in 75 in March or whenever it was, like I never in my life got tired of listening to him in a dressing room.
Really?
No, ever. We, you know, and it was funny, when I was involved with Kerry, with Eamon Fitzmaurice, before the 2016 All-Ireland semi-final, we were beaten by a couple of points, and we could have won.
I remember it. Yeah.
The Peter Crowley incident. And Eamon Fitzmaurice said to me, will we get Mikko in to present the jerseys to the boys on the Thursday night, give them their jerseys. And I said, God, my God, that would be a fantastic idea. And Eamon had an idea that we'd bring him to the hotel after. And Mikko was, Eamon was talking, didn't know, was it John or whoever? And Eamon says to me then, he said, do you know something? He says, should we bring him into the dressing room? And now the dressing room's obviously in Canada, they've changed totally.
Yeah.
And he was inside the dressing room. My God, you know something? I couldn't believe, like, that he spoke to the players so brilliantly. It was exactly like our day. And you know, for a man like in 2016,
he'd have been nearly 80 then, by the way. Yeah.
And he knew everybody. He knew every player. And everybody that came up to him offered their jersey, he had a word for them, you know, and obviously some of the bigger names, an extra little bit of a word. But he was incredible. And Ian had said it to me after, my God, he was in his natural habitat.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, like,
and maybe that's the trick. Maybe it's that he was never as comfortable as he was within a dressing room.
Never as comfortable. And the way he spoke, like, but, you know, and I just threw my eyes around the dressing room. The players were just in awe, you know.
Yeah.
You could hear a pin drop, you know. But he was an incredible man in my eyes.
You described him as the greatest manager that you've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that, did you choose that word properly, manager? Like, was he more a manager than a coach?
Well, he was everything.
He was everything, was he?
He was manager. He was a coach. He was the physical trainer, like, you think?
And the psychologist.
And the psychologist, which is the most important thing in my eyes, that he was.
Yes.
Yeah, and he was brilliant, you know. Even another part of his psychology was, he'd say, like, we'd be training awful hard and we'd be doing these long runs. Tough training, but nobody would ever refuse or nobody would ever will to them because you wouldn't want to. You wouldn't want to show weakness. And he'd say to me, anyway, he'd say, will you collect... 6 or 7 new footballs, anyway, for, you know, we knew then the weather was getting good, there'd be a ball coming, but he'd say, we'd be doing a session, like, we'd be doing maybe 4 nights consecutively, and we might have 2 hard nights done the next day. He'd say, look, we're getting there, and fellas and females, they're really going there, they're mad for ball, they'd be very little ball, and he'd say, do you know what, no, look, tomorrow night, no, look, we'll do another good tough session, and we're nearly there, but this is part of the psychology. We'd arrive into training then. We'd be out on the field, be lovely evening, bouncing the ball, and the new balls would be appearing anyway. So, like, the warm-ups were very little. The warm-ups, the key fellas used to stretch, all right, John Owens, and whoever else was there, Dean Henn, and then we'd do 2 laps of the field. The next thing he said, you know what we'd do now, lads? He'd pick out a bit of paper, and he'd have 2 teams picked in.
Yeah.
Fellas were like young calves under pressure. Jesus, he got more again out of fellas. No, I'm going to play football, but they'd be going through to be like a championship game.
And what is it, Mikey, about a footballer and the sight of a new O'Neill size 5? Isn't it?
Wow, it is amazing. Even when I was in Barbara Kerry, you'd see the new balls there, and you'd say, oh my God. Yeah. You know what it is? You know yourself. It's kind of, they nearly stick to your hands.
Yeah.
And they're just odd. Jesus, and they seem nicer to kick everything, but your twos.
And when they're pumped to the full, sometimes you feel they're too hard. Did you ever have any difficulty kicking frees off the ground with a new? You know what I mean? Like,
no,
sometimes, you were, because it was all off the ground then.
Well, all off the ground then. Maybe sometimes, but no, it never kind of bothered me really, Tony.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take any great notice. But it's sometimes now if you're playing an old club game, and maybe. It was like balloons that we can't hide together. Like, everyone would say, what's wrong with him today? But no, in general, no, they wouldn't.
How much did you concentrate more on practice as you got older, especially like with your free taking?
I'd say, do you know something? I think as I got older, I did less practice for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I always kind of felt it was on the day. Now, I do a good bit of practice, obviously, after training. You know, when we were leading up to a game, I'd spend maybe half an hour after training, and I'd have done a bit before training as well. But a lot of players would have gone down, I know that, I don't know about the present players, but up to maybe 10 years ago, I heard of players that go on the Friday night, you know, before a big game, they go down to their club feeling it. I never did that, no.
No.
No, I used to go actually out to Banner for a bit of a walk or whatever, you know. And
absolutely.
Again, that was part of the routine. Maybe I might go jog maybe for a half mile or something and then walk away, and just always on a Friday night on my own, nobody with me, way back over around the Cool Track.
Just
funny.
You mentioned there a while ago about, and I can vouch for this with you over the years, that you hate people, not that you hate is the wrong word, you've no problem with people coming up to you, but you don't have them talking about you.
No, absolutely.
And I remember a night many moons ago, and if you can imagine how long ago it is now, you and I, we were at a Rose Ball. We were talking at a Rose Ball one night, and I'd say we were standing together for about an hour, and the number of people that came up, did you ever get sick of it? I know Grant, you probably got sick of it, but did you ever?
Grant, you probably would. No, I wouldn't really, no, because I think most people are nice and they want to engage, they want to have a chat, and I have no issue with that. Like,
yeah.
Now, you wouldn't have this game as much nowadays because people wouldn't know you as much, but then you would. I have no issue with it. I don't know, maybe just about the way I was reared, just, but I didn't have any problem with it whatsoever, no. No issue with it, no.
I don't believe you that people don't come up these days to you.
Ah, they would. Some people would, like, you know, but in those days they would laugh. But I didn't ever bother, you know, and some fellas used to slag me, and they'd say, Jesus, if you're inside the bar for a couple of pints, and the biggest plague in the bar could come over to you.
Yeah.
But I had no issue with that, like, not at all. You know, I was trying to be nice to somebody, that was it.
And I know you said it's very much in how you were brought up, but was there ever a stage that you actually felt to yourself that it maybe was going to the head and you had to kind of pull yourself back?
Well, I'd say, do you know something? I don't think it did, because if it did, I'd have my wings clipped at home big time, like, you know.
By mother and father?
By both, yeah. Particularly by my father. He would. Because he was a very unassuming, quiet man. No, he never played. He played football in Clare years ago, I think with Long Rangers years. And he, you know, never at a high level, but
yeah.
he would still have that just, you know, you're only as good as your last game, and, you know, and you just be very, very grounded.
Right.
Very, very grounded. In a nice way.
You wouldn't ever,
you know, and, you know, I suppose it was funny, the rituals after games in those days, like, was that we go away, but groups of us, like, you know,
yeah.
there was never a function that night. And we kind of sat down, we'd all meet up in the grand and that. I'd always meet my mother and father and my sisters.
Right.
And grounded in when she came on the scene under the you know, the independent bridge outside Crow Park.
Oh yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Inside, just up there.
Yeah.
I'd meet them religiously after a game, and whether you won or lost. Now, mostly we were lucky enough that we won. They were there, and all they'll say to you, my father in particular, no, and he loved his football, loved going for a pint, and all they'd say was, well done or hard luck, and whether you were good or whether you were bad, it was the same story the whole time. But there was no, even if you were the best player on the field, you weren't going to get special treatment, or if you were the worst player, you'd get exactly the same reception.
So. He wasn't the kind of a father who said, like, should you not have passed that?
No, he never said a word.
Never.
No. He never, even, you know, never. Even after the 82 All-Ireland, like, and I missed the penalty at the crucial stage of the game, and he never even drew it down. Would you believe that? No, after, never. Never said, Jesus Christ, was an awful attempt, or
yeah.
never, you know, or what were you thinking, or were you not right kicking the ball, or whatever. No, never said it, or never said if you know, did something right, he never said it.
A question on that, by the way, you were probably centrally involved, you'd have to agree, in two of the most dramatic All-Irelands in the history of the GAA, in 78 and 82.
Yes.
Are you reminded more of the Paddy Cullen one, or are you reminded more of the Martin Furlong one?
No, would you believe it? And this is not, no, passing the buck. No, more about the Paddy
Cullen. I would have imagined so. Yeah,
there's most people want to talk about that. No, to be fair, very few people have mentioned 82, and I think Seamus Darby probably saved me.
Well, I was going to say the 82.
We all talk about Seamus Darby, even though my penalty was crucial at the time.
But here's the thing: yeah. I remember you and I chatting years ago, and you made a very fair point.
Yeah.
And I think somebody else was in the company the same night, and they said, that famous day in 1982,
yeah.
there wasn't too many other guys stepping up to take the penalty.
There was no volunteer, but there was plenty of volunteers later on that night, and they were all pissed like myself.
Yeah.
Why did you take it, and why I did take it, or this? But no, there wasn't. And look, I mean, you know, it was one of those things. And in fairness, to Offaly, you know something, and I know a lot of the Offaly lads very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I suppose of all counties to beat you know something,
yeah.
they weren't a bad bunch, they were great for a small county.
Yeah.
They won hurling All-Irelands, they won football All-Irelands, no Gav Shane, golfers, one of the best golfers.
Yeah.
They're great, and they're nice people.
And in 1980, there was that classic shootout in the semi-final.
That's right.
When Matt Connor got
2-9.
And in 81...
Then Jerry Carroll hit the crossbar at a crucial stage in that game. A lot of people don't remember. Midway through the second half.
In which one?
The 81 final.
Okay.
He hit the crossbar, take back in it. And Charlie, brilliant keeper, beat and hit the crossbar and came out. And it was a very important stage to be in the second half.
Because I remember the goal, the famous goal where Micheál O'Hare said, "I know they're really rolling." Do you remember he walked it up and Jacko?
That's right.
Like that, that came at a vital stage. I mean, I guess there was only 10 or 15 minutes left and it was in the melting pot.
Vital stage. What, the game was in the melting pot?
Yeah.
And as I said, I'll take you back to that shot by Jerry Carroll off the crossbar. So they were close enough to us always. Like,
yeah.
You know? And Eugene McGee, the late Eugene McGee, God rest his soul, he was a brilliant coach. Like, he was a very good tactician. Now, that would come from more from talking to John Owen Ogie, who had played under him in UCG.
Right.
He was ahead of his time as well. Very, very... very, very astute man on the line.
How long, forget the penalty, I mean, I'm talking about the actual being denied history.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to shake that out of your system for good?
Like a long time. Because I would have felt, you know, particularly bad, obviously, about missing the penalty. And I know how much it meant to Micheál and all that now. And Micheál took Micheál. I'd say Micheál, then a lot of people said Micheál never got over it.
No.
Probably we didn't either. But as I said, the other time does, you know. But I'd say I went through a bad phase for a long time after.
Like as in months or years?
Oh, I'd say years.
You really?
Know, years, just thinking about it. No, not on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You know, there could be a lot worse than that. But just it would have, hit me fairly hard.
Yeah. I get that because it's the old saying, isn't it? Like, you remember the losses more than the wins.
Big time. I would have said that. I'd said that to you before when we were doing an interview. That definitely you'll remember, you know, when somebody said to you, "What do you remember more?" Well, you remember 82 comes straight away to me first. Like,
really?
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
That would come to me first. Like, yeah.
Do you have all your 8 medals left?
I do. I have.
Do you know where? Given how meticulous you were about everything, you must have come.
They're inside in a box somewhere. We don't do that.
I thought you'd have made brooches and stuff out of them.
Made brooches? No. I have 4 grandchildren now, and I'd say I look after them with medals down the road. No, you know that's the way it would be. You know that's not. They're inside the box somewhere. Genuinely, Grant, you know where they are. I have no idea where they are now.
There's yourself, P.O. Spillane
and
Porridge. And
Ogie. Five of us.
Oh, is there five with eight?
Yeah. 5 with 8.
And I think Cluxton did Cluxton get to the 8?
Mm-hmm. He did, but they're incredible, like, and yeah.
Okay.
And James McCarthy has 8, hasn't he? There's a few of them have 8.
Fenton?
No. No. Fenton doesn't have 8. James McCarthy definitely did. Philly McMahon probably has 8. He was going a good bit. Stephen Cluxton definitely has 8. There must be a couple of more.
You saw them, Mikey, at close quarters because you were a selector with Fitzmaurice.
I did.
Now, in fairness, I would have to say of Fitzmaurice, I think he must have been one of the unluckiest Kerry managers. Like, I mean, you look at 2013, the no-show in 2015,
right.
And yet still could have got a draw with it at the end. The semi-final in 2016.
Could have gone our way.
I guess you, with your football brain, would look at that Dublin side and say, what was their special attribute?
I just think it sounds very simple, but they just stuck, as Jim Gavin always said, stuck to the process. They never panicked like that. I never saw any of them panicking out in the field. The only time I saw a little bit of a chink was that day in the 2016 semi-final, before half-time. And we caught them for the 2 goals.
I remember. One of them was off a short kick out to the Hogan stand side. Yeah,
they kind of pressed it that we had walked on. And the killer for us that time was at half-time, came at the wrong time.
It did.
We had them. They were panicking a little bit because myself and Morfitt were above them. And we had just come down just before half-time. And we were just on the sideline, just there. And you could see. And they were beginning to get cranky with each other, you know, funny enough. And I'll always remember, James McCarthy got a dunt from one of our lads. Just going after him, like, to me, he's a Rolls-Royce player.
Mm.
I think Brian Fenton, like, has probably been, you know, again, he's up with Jacko, probably. But I think of all the players I've seen with Dublin, I think he's the best.
Really?
I do.
That's interesting.
I think he's the Rolls-Royce. He's played... I think he played fullback or some National League. I mean, Antonio Walsh played centre back, wing back,
midfield.
He could play anywhere. But he got a dumped goal in, and he was sore going in, like I could see them. And he came out in the second half, Tony, like, and he just dominated the game.
Yeah.
Down. And again, Jim Gavin, and I say Rico is the greatest, and I would still say that, but Jim Gavin would be very, very close to him.
Yeah.
Obviously, with his record. And I think Jim Gavin, you know, he was so calm as well on the sideline. Like, and the thing I would say about him, that whether it has come from his background in the army and the Air Corps or whatever, but, you know, a very gracious man, always. Like, mostly he was consoling us, but he was even, we beat him in the National League final and once or twice, never beat him in a big championship game. Mm. But I always just felt, do you know something about the players, even you remember 2015 that we played terrible and could have snuck a draw and it would have been robbery. But I just felt even the Dublin players out on the pitch, yeah, they were elated and that, but they were grounded. I'm sure once they got into their dressing room, they were mad.
Yeah.
But there was this kind of, what's the word I'd use?
Bit of dignity?
Dignity, absolutely.
Yeah. You know?
And I think Dublin people should realise, and I'm sure they do, that these are a special bunch.
Absolutely. I think dignified is probably a better word than dignity. It's dignified, yeah,
and
I think.
And yeah. I wouldn't know a lot of them, no. You know, yeah. I don't think I ever spoke that much to anybody, any of them. But when you did meet them, yeah, they're very, 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 very sound young lads. You know, very, as I said, dignified is a very good description.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the last time you and I actually chatted, I was doing a piece about the fantastic corner forwards that had gone through the generations from Mikey to Morris to Gooch to Clifford.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, being you, wrote yourself out of the conversation I want to actually argue that with you a small bit now. You leave yourself out of the conversation.
Yes. Yes.
How do you, which of the other three would you like most in your team?
Oh, jeez, that's a difficult one. I tell you, the three of them, like the three exceptional players, Morris, Gooch, and David. Do I have to give you one? I do.
Could you imagine them as a full forward line? Because you could actually play Morris as a 15 because he was two-footed. You could play Clifford at 13. You could play Gooch at full forward.
You could. Like David Clifford is exceptional, like, you know, but he's still only, what is he, 22, 23, who I couldn't give you an answer because I'd love to play with the second three of them.
But I think
given anything to play with the three of them, you know, I think they're all exceptional. I think David, obviously, he's very young and I think he's going to shoot the lights out, but I think Morris and Gooch, like in the talk about our team now, they would be on any team, like in my hands, like you'd have to pick a spot.
They were artists.
Oh jeez, artists completely, like,
yeah.
Two of the greatest that have ever done.
Yeah.
In the green and gold.
And I remember you telling me one time, like obviously when you were involved with Kerry, obviously you saw Gooch two nights a week in training in Killarney when no one else did.
Absolutely.
And I remember even Pat Shea talking to me about this. Obviously, Pat would know him better than any of us. Some of the things he could do with the ball. And I'm not just talking about scoring. I'm just talking about his creativity.
Actually, in 2016, it was like a new lease of life to him. And I remember, it probably was the time when you were over there. That we were over, do you know where you have your spot over yourself in the air?
Yeah. Portugal,
we had an AVB game one evening. I'd say we were like Amos. But we don't have a game because it was our first evening there. And it was a beautiful tour. It was a Thursday evening, I'd swear. And we had an AVB game. I'd say it was that year, possibly. Gooch was on the 40 and Eamon reffed it. And he just left it flowing. Well, there was a bit of clipping going on, right?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus, it was the best football I've seen. Like, oh my God, it was absolutely. But the Gooch was absolutely in his pomp.
Really?
Oh my,
in terms of what?
Just everything. Just being clinically, but his vision was absolutely frightening. Like, I mean, he I always kind of felt that he'd eyes in the back of his head. Then we were playing, training in Killarney, and he probably doesn't even remember this himself, like. And he pinged a pass, he was over on the teller side, the opposite end now to the dressing room end, and he was over on the right hand side. He was playing something, but he drifted out on a ball. And one of our lads went through, I can't remember, I know the player, but I won't because I don't remember. And he got a ton of respect for the pass. But your man's pass was so good. It's actually tremendous here.
In the throat.
On the throat. Well, like,
yeah.
No, your man should have caught it. He should have been smart enough. But he would just come. But he hit it with the outside of his foot. Oh, my God. Just incredible. He was there another day that I saw him. And it was shortly after his mom passed away. And we didn't even want him there. I'd say she passed away during the week. He came down and he went for a few kicks. And Eamon had the boys up at the other end of the field. And I was on the sideline with Murph, I'd say to us, and or somebody. And next thing he started kicking from the terrace side down into the dressing room end. From the left side.
So it was the wrong side for him, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I tell you, no exaggeration. He pinned, I'd say he took 10 kicks and I don't think he missed one.
Over the bar, outside of the boot, obviously.
Outside the boot every time. Like he was just an incredible player. But see, the first time I saw Gooch playing was I was involved with Charlie, he was a minor.
Yeah.
And again, what year was it? It was 2000 and, was it 2001 maybe?
Or even 99, 2000, I think, yeah.
2000 maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in Parky Cleeve. My God almighty. He gave an exhibition that day. It was incredible.
And he was probably about 4 stone then.
The jersey was too big for him. And he had it outside him. And it was hanging off him now into the street.
Yeah.
Hanging off him. He was then lost inside the jerseys. And I wouldn't be 100% sure. But I would say Cork management tried 3 or 4 different markers on him at the same time. And we were sitting in the old dugouts in Cork, I remember now, it was an awful place to watch the game because you were below the
grass, like, yeah, I do, yeah.
And I was watching it. And next thing, the second half in particular, he went to Tone and the Montaigne. And all I used to do was he'd get the ball, right, and next thing, he'd give a shimmy, he'd play 1-2, the other 10, and all you'd see was the ball in the air, and all I was doing was looking at the umpire, and all you could see was the umpire, he was pointing as the ball was in the air. Oh, he was just absolutely... And Dublin beat us in the All-Ireland semi-final. And we'd have beaten them if we could get enough ball into the same day.
Which year? In...
It was either 2000 or 2001 in the All-Ireland
semi-final.
Okay, yeah. Because Danny Halfins likes me, he was on the bench. Why didn't you bring me on?
Yeah. That semi-final in 2013, was it a final or semi-final?
Semi-final. Yeah.
What an exhibition he gave that day. If they could have got, he could have got the ball.
He would have killed the game. Oh, he was incredible.
Do you think? I mean, I'm not going to ask you about them being like you,
yeah,
but the way you're talking there, you really appreciated his talents because it was all about the vision and the pass and the accuracy. Which, let's face it, if I was to describe yourself, similar.
Another attribute that I always thought that he had, which I loved about him as well, like, is that he was totally unselfish, like, for such a brilliant player. Like, you know, if he saw a player in a better position, that player always got the ball. And I see him doing that even in training. Always. He was never one of these guys. You know, you see a lot of the top players and they're great, and sometimes they can say, well, you know, if there's a chance of goal and there's a chance of making sure of it, they'll have a go.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll take the chance. And most times they'll nail it, right, because they're that good. But no, if he saw somebody in a better position and he failed to make sure that we were going to get a goal, he'd give the ball to the man in the battle.
Do you have a theory at all, Mikey? And I know this is a very kind of a deep question now, like, but do you have a theory at all as to why Kerry produces that type of footballer? The four that I've mentioned.
I just think it goes to tradition in that we're so in that, and this doesn't want to sound beheaded by Kerry people, is that football, as you know, Tony, it's a religion, like it is, and you know, other sports are making inroads certainly around, but there's nothing will ever surpass Gaelic football in Kerry, and I think, you know, even the likes of David Clifford, not as young as now, they're aspiring to be David Cliffords, and I just, you know, I'm hearing great reports about underage football, under 14s and under 16s around the county.
Mm.
Father John, I know my great friend, he goes to pilot those underage games and college games, and you hear about these different lads like coming through. I just think it's a tradition, and I know, like, I when I was growing up, like, as I said, I had 6 sisters, so, you know, and I didn't have any brother as such to keep ball, even though some of the girls used to be kicking ball to me. But that's all I wanted to do was play with Kerry. And I don't know how. Now, you know, my father was a fanatic in the game, and my mother's family would have been interested in the game. But I just wanted to do that. And I think that's
did you have someone to look up to? Like Morris might have looked up to you, like Gooch might look up to Morris.
I would look up to Mick on every time.
Would you? As a player?
I would.
Yeah,
I would.
Corner forward, wing forward.
Because my father, God rest him, used to always say that Mick's best position, he saw Mick O'Dwyer play his best football as a wing back. He broke his leg. I think he broke his leg twice.
He did. He had a couple of bad breaks, I remember him saying.
He's an incredible wing back. Yeah. But and then he was the man I always looked up to Mick O, and obviously Mick O'Connell as well. I used to just admire Mick O, you know, when I used to see him in Croke Park, and you know, I know he was in a totally different position to me, but my God, he was a purist, like he was a beautiful footballer, a beautiful kicker of the ball.
Yeah.
And just he was I always kind of felt about Mick O'Connell, he was ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he'd have played well in any era.
Tell me, just going back, and I'm bringing it right back now before we finish, to current day. I mean, you're sitting here and you've, you know, had an incredible history. When you look at, we'll say, some of the great players, you know, and they might not necessarily have, eight All-Ireland medals, like, I mean, who were the players that you actually were always looking at, whether it was while you were playing or since or after you, where you actually looked at them and thought to myself, like, yeah, I can pick up something from him, or he's, you know, that kind of a player. Is there somebody like that?
Yeah, there'd be a few players that I would have always liked. And again, of course, they'd be calling forwards, like, and watching since. And even when I was playing, one fella who I used to love watching, and he played against us, so obviously it was Matt Connor, who was an absolute genius.
Genius.
Absolutely.
There's an entire generation now have no idea actually how good Matt Connor was.
Matt Connor was up there with that. Like Matt had that tragedy when he was in 26 or 27.
Whatever.
I don't think, you know, but so to me he was incredible. Do you know who was another player who I used to love watching was Tony McManus from Roscommon. Tony was a beautiful player. And other corner forwards then was what's his name from Down? I think he was a brilliant footballer. It was Mickey Linden.
Yeah. God, he played up. Absolutely. He played into his 40s.
Absolutely incredible footballer. Mm. Incredible footballer. But you know who I think pound for pound is probably one of the best that's ever played? Is Peter Cannon, obviously.
Would you?
Oh, Jesus, absolutely. I think he was an incredible footballer. Like,
yeah.
Not a big man. Oh, my God, what a brave man. But what a brilliant footballer, man.
Yeah.
Gee, I thought his goal against us was it in what year?
2008. The one where he slipped it down beside Morph?
Yeah, Jesus.
Yeah, off his weak side.
Off his weak side. Like, it was incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. And he'd do that all day long. That was just like him doing something out in the back garden.
Yeah.
You know? And even what year was it? He took the ball off Mosey Mulligan, do you remember, to kick it over against Armagh.
That's right.
I mean, you know, it wasn't a difficult kick for him, but it was a difficult kick.
Yeah.
It was a pressure kick.
Yeah.
But again, it was like as though he was down on his club pitch and kicked it over the bar. I think Peter Canavan, like Tom Mooney, is good at the play again.
Okay, let's finish just by going back. Your career,
yes,
such as it was, and it was an epic career. When you're washing the dishes, or when you're ever sitting down,
right? I'd be impressed with that.
Yeah.
What
do you think of? What are the things that come into your mind's eye when you're kind of talking about those days, those great golden years, as they called?
Do you know what I loved about those days? Like, particularly when you won, was having the crack, having it, you know, and the friends that you made, you know that, no? The friendships, really, Tony, because, do you know, it's funny, when we were playing, and our rivals, like, would have been Dublin and Cork, you know, Cork and Munster, like, you know, and, you know, and but we never had a great relationship with the boys, the Cork fellas or the Dublin fellas. A little bit with the Dublin lads because they used to come to the store, but the Cork lads until we finished.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing, you know?
Mm.
And when we finished. Now, the only lad that I would have been initially very friendly with Cork was Dinny Allen.
Yeah.
Because I met Dinny, we were an All-Star tour in 76, and myself and Matt Connor having a few sessions together. Good crack. But Dinny was working down here then. I can't remember what year.
He was in finance, wasn't he, or something?
No, that was after.
Oh, that was after.
He was a rep with Heineken.
Okay.
And Dinny, he was down. That was around 1980, because I got married in 1980, because Dinny was down. I think he gave me I think he sponsored a keg of Heineken for the stay.
Of course.
And he was with us. So, but since then, you know, and just the friendships, and I suppose sometimes what you would say to yourself, Tony, like, and this doesn't, I don't want this to come out calm, you know, whatever you put it up, is the fact of being lucky to have been involved with that squad and the greatest manager of all time.
Right? Yeah.
That's what I said, you know, you could have been in an era where things weren't good, you know, and you're still putting in the same effort.
Yeah, 86 to 97.
Yeah.
Because the year that came after.
Twice. Absolutely. You think of it. And that's what I do think, you know, about being lucky to have been involved and to have made lifelong friends, you know, from Kerry in particular and from other counties.
Yeah. Are you too busy in the moment, or do you realise in those 75s, obviously beaten in 76 and 77 and then 78 and then the run, do you realise right then in the midst of it that you're in the middle of something very special, or are you just too busy?
No, too busy.
Playing,
absolutely, and just wanting to win and win and win. Yeah, absolutely. But you don't realize it. You don't realize that this legacy is going to be there, and it's something that you can look at. No, you never think of that. Totally.
Yeah,
no, that never ever crossed my mind. No.
And how many kids do you have?
I have two boys.
Two boys. And I mean, when we're talking about not taking anything for granted, and I mean, we were talking about other stuff earlier, Mikey had a bad health scare.
He did in 2013. Yeah.
Tell us about that and how it affected you and how it put everything we're talking about
into perspective. Yeah. Yeah, he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Right.
Just out of the blue, basically. Like, he, and in fairness to the guy, he pursued it himself, you know, that he was just playing golf and he was carrying his bag and he just felt soreness down here, and between the jigs and reels, he went for blood tests and they told him he was fine initially, and then they discovered that he had the diagnosis. It was May 19 or in 2013, and he went through his chemo, 6 months of it, and thank God, touch wood,
came
out the right side of it. And, you know, so it does put everything into perspective. But I was involved with Kerry at the time.
Right.
And it certainly was a distraction, but it was difficult. Now, I never left it affect myself, but it's amazing that Grania, my wife, I think women, now you might differ, but this is my personal opinion, women are better to deal with situations like that.
I wouldn't disagree with you.
I was in denial a little bit about it, you know, and, you know, people then would ask you about it. I wouldn't say a whole lot about it. And didn't want to talk about it and kind of was putting it to the background. No, even though he was there for support, even when he was going through the chemo, it was tough, like, it was tough, you know. With this,
and he'd have been only in his 30s at the time.
That's it, 8 years ago, it would be. And, but thank God, as I said to you, he came out. But there were times, you know, that you'd be there inside in bed at night and you're looking up at the ceiling and you're kind of saying, like, Why us? And there's several families have been struck with it, as you well know. And you know, and you'd be kind of saying, look, I'm 60 or whatever it is, like, Jesus, why wasn't it me? You take it for him, you know, at that age. But thank God it worked out. And you know, I wouldn't be, look, I'm a Catholic, but you know, I'd be lukewarm enough at times.
With your faith, like, yeah.
With your faith, even though my mother, God rest her, Jesus, she was a daily mass score and gave us great values and all that, but there is something there, Tony, because you do get strength somewhere, like.
Yeah,
definitely it did. And as it was going on, then you get a bit more positive about it, and thankfully then the news was positive in November, and it was amazing because his wife Suzanne, she was pregnant with their second kid Alva at the time, so that was extra, and Alva was born just as he finished his chemo. It was amazing, like.
Wow.
So it was. So, but it does definitely put everything into perspective.
Yeah.
You kind of say, look, you know, you're not going to be getting this down after losses or whatever, you know.
No.
You would obviously be disappointed, but nah, look, it's a game.
And when he went into public life.
Yes.
And he's now a county councillor, Fianna Fáil County Councillor, yes. Kerry County Council, and he says that you were a brilliant canvas. Tell us about it. I could not imagine Mikey Sheehy going up knocking on the door, even though, like, let's face it, if people open their door and Mikey Sheehy is wrong, actually is at their front door, that's a number one.
Well, I don't think so, Tony. But look, it's he likes doing what he's doing, you know. But I certainly, I don't know when the next county council elections are on, but I'm not looking forward to having to go knocking on doors again if we do have to, you know. But I'd support him, of course, at whatever he's doing, you know. But certainly it's not top of my agenda.
So the night that you were sent up a road in a housing estate on your own there, knocking on doors, what happened? How many doors did you actually knock on?
Well, I don't remember. A few, I'd say. I kind of half knocked, pretended.
And then stuck the leaflet.
Stuck the leaflet in the door and I was gone. Actually, it was like a fella running for a breaking ball. I took it straight out and I was gone. But that was it. I looked, it was fun.
Mikey, thanks a million.
No problem, Tony. Bye. Pleasure. No problem.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.